Dr. Michael Roizen.
Dr. Michael Roizen.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
If you like music, you're going to like what Dr. Neil Barnard, a cardiologist, a person who loves to reverse diabetes, and a accomplished musician, has to say about the power of music to change habits or to make habits better. I often think of music as learning how to play chopsticks, and the first couple times is really difficult, and by the time you've played it 50 times, your neighbor is tired of it, but you've established the habit. Dr. Neil Barnard is a superb physician who founded the physician, the, tell me, Neil, what is the organization? Isn't it called the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine?
That's exactly right.
And where you're listening to you, the Owner's Manual podcast number 855. This is the B segment where we get to interview great guests. And although I've done this in a relatively backward way, let me introduce Dr. Neil Barnard. Neil, tell me about your music accomplishments, because those may even be more impressive.
Well, thank you for saying that. My parents raised their family in Fargo, North Dakota, and they got the idea that any civilized person ought to be able to play at least two instruments. So throughout, you know, starting at about age six, I was sort of chained to the piano and cello, and all through medical school and residency and so forth, I've always had bands, and I've released CDs and everything. However, I always kept it completely separate from my medical practice because I never thought there was any overlap.
But, so what were you, well, wait a second, what was your music name when you released these CDs, et cetera?
Oh, well, the most recent one is called Carbon Works, as in we are made of carbon and these are our works. And in fact, if you go on YouTube and you search Carbon Works, you'll see us there. And there are a lot of videos, and we have a lot of radio play. We have one of our songs has been on the top 40 for a couple of months, and we've got some really, really good musicians. And I'm this is quite apart from the whatever medicinal effect there may be from music.
Ben is our engineer today, and I don't know if you have Ben louder than words able to be pulled up and patched in, but I would love, we can play that in the background anytime you want, Ben. So the one that's been in the top 40, as I understand it, is louder than words.
That's it. When we released this record, some of the music is really rather adventurous and a little experimental, but that one just sort of grabbed the mainstream adult contemporary radio producers, and they kept spinning it and spinning it and spinning it, which is a nice thing to see.
Now, one of the great physicians in this area was in New York, and I believe he recently died. Is that right?
I'm not sure who we're thinking of.
And I am blanking on his name right now. But one of the things I did get to do is participate both at Lincoln Center and in Vienna on a symposium between the Cleveland Orchestra and the Cleveland Clinic on music in the brain, and learned, in fact, that they did a relatively randomized study. It wasn't purely randomized, but close, where they had people get tickets to soccer games and or what they call football, or people to London Symphony, and then followed them for a number of years. And the interesting thing, and obviously it wasn't perfectly randomized, but the people who went to the symphony and attended regularly ended up the equivalent of 3 years younger than their calendar age. And those who that change, that is the change afterwards, and the soccer viewers ended up 3 years older. So it was about a six-year delta if you regularly attend concerts as opposed to regularly attend football games.
It does raise the question of whether music is good for you or whether soccer is bad for your brain. But You were talking, I remember who you're talking about. You're thinking of Oliver Sacks,
who was
a neurologist. He did, in fact, die a couple of years ago at the ripe old age of, I think he was maybe 80, over 80 years of age. But he did write a lot about the the medicinal effects of music. And yes, there are lots of physical effects of it. And when Carbon Works does music, we just do what we think we want to hear, and it's fun and very diverse, and we have lots of foreign languages and funny meters in what we do and stuff. But I have been really quite struck by what Oliver Sacks and others have shown, that music, there's a reason why we gravitate toward it so strongly, and that reason is in the core of the brain.
And so in this core of the brain, what you and others have shown, and I think you most prominently, so we ought to give credit where credit is due, that in fact you turn on the dopaminergic reward system in both the caudate and the nucleus accumbens. Is that right?
Well, yeah. Here's how this started. We didn't intend to go down this road at all, but what happened was that we were doing some diabetes research for NIH, and we put people on vegan diets, and they lost weight, and they did fantastic. They got much, much healthier. However, I started to notice that some people had a little more trouble than others sticking with their healthy diet. And so I genotyped everybody. I was looking for a gene that would cause people to have too little dopamine in their brain. And as you said, brain's the reward chemical. To make a really long story short, here's what we found. About half of people with type 2 diabetes are, in addition to whatever genes they have that lead them toward diabetes, about half of them also have a gene that means they have too few dopamine receptors in their brain. That, in turn, means they are drawn to anything that triggers dopamine release. They're not aware of why they are drinking or smoking or taking drugs or eating junk food, but it is the desire for dopamine. And so if food is your drug of choice to get the dopamine that you're lacking, you're going to gain weight. And if you gain weight, your diabetes could kick in and all that kind of stuff. So if you are born with this tendency, what can you do? Music triggers dopamine too. And that is the surprising thing. And exactly what you said is true. Let's say you're listening to a song and you know this song and you love it. You're putting it on. As you're anticipating the part of the music that is the most emotionally intense, the caudate nucleus, which is in the brain, lights up with dopamine activity. And then at the point that you hit that emotional peak, the nucleus accumbens lights up. And these are the same, these are part of the reward center of the brain, which is what drugs stimulate, what alcohol stimulates, and what junk food stimulates, except you just did it with no calories, no cholesterol. It's not going to make you drive funny. Will not hurt you in any way. It's a safe form of dopamine, and that's a good thing.
Now, I love some forms of music more than others. Does that mean that type of music is genetically favorable to me and I will release dopamine and the stuff I don't like won't? And how much of that, and let me ask the second part of that question, how much of that is learned versus how much of it is natural?
Great question. I think that what is natural to you, what is physiological to you, is the musical recognition hardware in the brain. So you can recognize melodies, you can encode them, you can remember them. And what is learned, what is cultural, is the form of the music, the type of music. So if I took you and I raised you in a different culture with different music, you would find something that you liked, which is quite different from what you actually have learned in your lifetime. And yes, the learning process does change which types of music are effective. Now, you would think, all right, it's got to be happy music. It's got to be music that makes me tap my toe, and that's the stuff that's going to get the dopamine going in my brain. Not exactly. If you listen to sad music, like if you put on Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata, it's very slow and almost funereal, that will trigger dopamine release too. So it can be happy, it can be sad. The thing that they have in common, though, is you have to like it. You have to gravitate toward it. If it's bluegrass and you just hate bluegrass, or if it's hip-hop and that's just not your thing, then you will not get the dopamine release. So it's got to be something you like. It can be happy. It can be sad. And you do see the dopamine release at the times in the music when it is, when the emotional parts are approaching and when they actually hit.
More with Dr. Mike Roizen and the You, the Owner's Manual podcast coming up. We just want to let you know today's episode is brought to you by That's It. Did you know that only 1/3 of Americans get their proper servings of fruits and vegetables? At That's It, they made it their mission to fix this by finding a way to finally make produce portable while still preserving its nutritional value. That's It started with their famous fruit bars. You've probably seen them. They are made with only 2 ingredients, fruit and, well, fruit. That's it. Seriously. Now, after popular demand, they are changing the way you eat your veggies with That's It veggie bars. Featured in 4 flavors, black beans and kale, peas, carrots, and corn. Each bar is under 100 calories, contains 4 grams of green protein, and like their fruit bars, contain no preservatives, are gluten-free, non-GMO, contain no fat, are kosher, vegan-friendly, and contain 4 grams of fiber. Each bar contains 1 full serving of vegetables. It's the simple and easy way to get your daily serving of veggies. Want to try it for yourself? Go to thatsitfruit.com and enter the code YOU, that's Y-O-U, to save 10% off any order today. They're only available online right now, but keep an eye out for them soon at your favorite local retailers. Once again, thatsitfruit.com with promo code YOU, that's Y-O-U, to save 10% off any order today. So don't forget to eat your veggies. Now back to Dr. Mike Roizen.
So I grew up in the time of Frankie Valli and the Beatles' early records. And I love that, and that was part of my formative years, if you will. I mean, that dates me. But I still love all the Jersey Boy songs and all the Beatles songs. And I don't like those when I was older and the newer music. Is that related to that my formative years and growing up with happy thoughts with those or with those thoughts, or could I relearn, if you will, the music of today if I wanted to? In other words, what I'm trying to say is how much of this, once I've got that, developed that habit, how much of that is the habit versus how much of that is just I've changed my brain that I'm always going to have that?
That I don't know, and I have pondered that over and over again. You could lock yourself in a room and listen to Donna Summer's disco records for the next 2 months, Mike. I'm not sure if you would emerge unscathed, and I don't think you can make yourself like it. Now, nothing against Donna Summer, because many people adore her, and they wouldn't have liked the music that you grew up with. So, why this happens, and why some people say like bluegrass, others don't, who knows? However, what you pointed out is really important, that there was a certain time in your life when the music got into your brain and you still like it. In Alzheimer's patients, you can see a reduction in agitation. Let's say you've got a person. They no longer know the names of their children, or they may not know the name of their own spouse, for example. And if you were to look at the brain structure, it has been largely destroyed. However, you play them a song that they knew when they were young, or you even just speak the lyrics to them, they will often start singing it. If you make a mistake in the melody yourself, they will correct you, suggesting that the music recognition neuronal structures are preserved even when much of the cortex has been destroyed. And so if you've got a person who's agitated every day in the late afternoon, you play about 30 minutes of music. And don't play the Beatles' greatest hits played by the Holly Ridge Strings if they hated that when they were little. Ask the family, what did they listen to, and play that about 30 minutes, and you'll discover they are calmer during that time, and they are calmer afterward. And you can do the same thing for a pre-op patient. You're going to have your hip replaced. You're nervous. sure, I can give you a benzodiazepine, you know, like Valium, Librium, to calm you down. You get a better result, better anxiolytic result by giving them music that they have selected. When they come out of surgery, if you track their use of pain medication and you have half of your participants listen to music, the other half don't, you don't tell them what you're doing, but you record how much pain medicine they're using. If they listen to music regularly, they take significantly less pain medication afterward. So you're just exploiting the effect of music on these core brain functions of knocking out anxiety, knocking out agitation, knocking out physical pain or the perception of that physical pain through this almost sort of intrapsychic acupuncture that we call music.
Now, one of the other, if I can add it, one of the other concepts, I think, is that, and this is that when you can learn something better with certain music. That is, if you like something, such as, you know, Big Girls Don't Cry, one of my favorite songs, if I play that, I often learn better. Is that a true effect, or is that just a perceived effect?
I don't know. But we do know that that music is, when, let's say you're playing that song and you are learning something, you code the two together. So when whatever it was that you learned, let's say you're learning a new language or you're learning some chemistry facts or you're reading a medical journal, the next time you encounter whatever it is you learned, the music comes along with it. I don't know if you've experienced that. You think, ah, you know, and you're almost humming the song as you're rereading that material or whatever. You remember.
And I'm trying to play louder than words in the background at the same time. So if people are hearing that, that's what that is from Carbon Works. But, Neil, it works the other way, too, is what you said. That is, if I trigger music, I remember a memory. That is, the music triggers learning, too.
Yes. You know, in other words, the old-fashioned idea is a fact is a fact, a name, a song is a song, and that's all it is. Uh-uh. You memorize not just that bit, but you memorize a whole package of stuff together. And then when you recall it, that whole package comes out, too. Smells can be like that. A smell can remind you suddenly of your grade school, and you remember the hallway and your teacher and everything. And when we use this medicinally, one of the more interesting studies was in the labor and delivery suite when women were giving birth. Needless to say, they rated their pain more and more intensely as the birth process continued. However, if you give women a physical massage, you rub their shoulders the whole time during the birth process, they record their pain noticeably less. If you do the experiment again, no massage, but you give them constant music that they've pre-selected, they rate their pain much less, and it's the equivalent of a constant physical massage through the entire birth process. So you can use these things, and music is not going to replace the use of pain-killing drugs and so forth, but it can greatly reduce the amount of medications that people need for certain things, and it provides a connecting language for folks for whom you're having difficulty connecting.
Now, one of the questions one of our email listeners sent in, that is, who got a tweet that we were interviewing you today beforehand, sent in a question and said, if music is so good, why do musicians use so many drugs too?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. You never see the musician stop their performance and go out to say, I really need to eat, to have junk food, or I need a drink, or I need cocaine or something like this now in the performance. The performance is triggering dopamine in their brains at the time. And I think what happens, the reason musicians, and it's not just musicians, it's sort of anybody who's achieved fame, wealth, and also a chaotic lifestyle, you put those things together and they're not at home and they lose all their normal structures, and then they can lapse into alcohol and drugs and all kinds of things. You could take that same musician. You give them lots of music. Let's say they play with the local symphony, but they're not traveling, they're not on the road, their family is there, they're getting lots of music, but they don't lapse into drugs, they don't lapse into alcohol at all. So the point I'm making, it's not the music that did that. The music, in fact, has a good brain effect on them, no matter what they are. But if you take the musician, you put them on the road, take away all their family structure, give them a lot of money and a lot of free time, and it disrupts their sleep, then they lapse into all manner of bad habits.
They need more, if you will, drugs to
well,
help them.
Well, you can do the same thing. Take away the music. Let's say it's a person on a film set. It's a star in a movie, and they've got money and sleep deprivation and a chaotic lifestyle, and the use of drugs and alcohol and stuff is just legion in all of these kinds of things. So the point I'm making is that there is drug use in a lot of very successful musicians. It has to do with their success. It doesn't have to do with the music.
One of the things you're listening to is Carbon Works, CARBONWORKS, Carbon Works, playing Louder Than Words, part of Neil Barnard's, the physician I'm talking to's, great works. He's also a NIH-funded investigator, what we call the highest form of investigator. He's a great writer, wrote, I can't remember the name of the diabetes reversal book, Neil, but it was a wonderful book, and came out with another book recently on cheese.
The cheese trap, that's right.
And so, what was the diabetes book name?
Yeah, it had the immodest title of Dr. Neil Barnard's Program for Reversing Diabetes. So, and the book on the cheese trap was all about the drug-like effect that cheese tends to have, to some people's surprise. So my hope is that people will skip the cheddar and turn on the Beethoven, and Beethoven doesn't have any calories.
The other thing that you bring up, a lot of people, I mean, I am totally amazed by kids who remember the words to so many songs and don't remember other things. And so one of the triggers may be to have them play that song while they're trying to learn something else.
Yeah, you can certainly do that. You know, and people have done that with all kinds of things like the ABCs. And as I recall, some people even did that with the cranial nerves in medical school, putting it to a song. to each his own.
We're talking with a great physician, Neil Barnard. I've admired him as a physician. And now I guess we're going to admire him as a musician on You, the Owner's Manual radio show. It's no longer a radio show, podcast. We're glad you download us. About 50,000 of you are. And this is Louder Than Words by Carbon Works.
Could you understand? Yeah.